it's like I've just been hired for a job, essentially, by 17,000 people.
A new representative for House District 34. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, federal budget cutters target oil company tax breaks.
I mean, I get it. There's some people that don't like the oil and gas industry. Well, that doesn't, you know, they paid over $140 billion in taxes last year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Jonathan Kreis Tompkins appears to have won a seat in the Alaska House of Representatives. The Sitka Democrat remained ahead of Haines Republican incumbent Representative Bill Thomas after the final absentee ballots were counted today. The new totals were released shortly after 11:30 a.m. Jonathan Kreis Tompkins has 4,123 votes and Bill Thomas has 4,091. That puts Kreis Tompkins ahead by 32 votes.
It's like I've just been hired for a job, essentially, by 17,000 people. And it's like the acceptance letter has been strung out one sentence at a time, or the offer has been strung out one sentence at a time. So it's been a series of false summits and anticlimaxes and climaxes within the anticlimaxes and a lot of sort of emotional, I don't know. There is no sort of moment. And this isn't even the moment.
Thomas would not say today whether he'd request a recount, but in an interview with KHNS in Haines, he called Kreis Tompkins a name we won't repeat on the radio and didn't hesitate to make his feelings about the election known.
The district just, you know, committed Harry Carey, you know, and they just didn't realize what they had as far as seniority and leadership position.
Thomas says he'll look to do some lobbying for the commercial fishing industry, but doesn't plan to run for the legislature again. In another close race, Democrat Hollis French has retained his state Senate seat by just 54 votes. French's race against Republican businessman Bob Bell for a seat that represents South and West Anchorage attracted the most campaign spending this election in Alaska. French says he always knew the race would be close, but he didn't know just how close.
When you win by 54 votes out of 15,000, you feel proud and humble at the same time, proud of all the work you did, humble that, my opponent got a lot of votes. And there's a lot of people in the district who did not support me. You want to honor their thinking just like you honor the thinking of the people who supported you.
Bell was down by 250 votes on election night, but gained considerable ground on French as the absentee ballots were counted. He says it is frustrating to come so close to winning. He says he'll request a recount.
You never know, you know. It's what are we talking about? 0.3%. So it wouldn't. That's like three votes per precinct. So it wouldn't take much of a mistake to make a difference.
The recount will be free because the candidates are separated by less than 0.5%. The Division of Elections says it can happen within a day and has to be completed within 5 days of the request. The election is expected to be certified on Friday. It's been a slow week on Capitol Hill with lawmakers out for Thanksgiving, but talks are ongoing between congressional leaders and the White House about working to stave off the fiscal cliff and establishing the framework for a deficit reduction package. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, tax reform could play a significant part of the debt package, and the oil and gas industry is making sure it keeps its tax breaks.
President Barack Obama campaigned on a promise of fairness in the tax code. Speaking in the White House Rose Garden in March, Mr. Obama said there was no reason oil companies with record profits should receive billions of dollars in subsidies paid for by everyday citizens.
Instead of taxpayer giveaways to an industry that's never been more profitable, we should be using that money to double down on investments in clean energy technologies that have never been more promising.
Investments in wind, solar, and biomass. But with the country facing the combination of spectrum-wide tax increases and across-the-board cuts to government spending, it's unlikely any money saved from ending oil subsidies would go to more investments. It will likely go to lowering the nation's debt. There's a lobbying frenzy going on in Washington and in congressional districts across the country. The industry wants to preserve specific beneficial tax breaks. U.S. Senator Mark Begich says he met with representatives from Shell and BP last time he was in Alaska, and he met with the American Petroleum Institute earlier this week.
I mean, I get it. There's some people that don't like the oil and gas industry. Well, that doesn't, you know, they paid over $140 billion in taxes last year. You know, I can point to some industries that pay very little taxes and get a bunch of credits.
Some of that $140 billion was certainly passed on to consumers because it came from excise taxes. Senator Begich says if the government tackles the debt through tax reform, there's no reason to single out just one industry. And that's the argument Stephen Comstock is making. He works on tax policy at the American Petroleum Institute.
You should not take this time to have targeted tax raisers on any one particular industry.
Comstock says API is willing to sit down and discuss its tax preferences when the government takes on true fundamental tax reform, but that's not happening right now.
We aren't in any way, shape, or form offering anything at this point.
Many think Congress will work to overhaul the tax code for both citizens and corporations in the spring. And when it does, Daniel Weiss has his eyes on certain deduction used by major oil producers. Weiss is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He says the subsidy for intangible drilling benefits has been on the books since 1916. It allows oil companies to write off the cost of labor up front, instead of over the lifespan of the well.
Companies that don't drill have to take deductions for their expenses over time rather than getting those deductions all at once. Getting them all at once means it's like getting a lump sum rather than getting your allowance every week.
Not all oil companies qualify for the various subsidies, and it's not the biggest producers who necessarily benefit the most. Eric Toder is co-director of the Tax Policy Center. He also served as an undersecretary of the Treasury. He says that independent producers, meaning not the integrated companies that refine and market products, fare better than the majors. Independent producers are worried about losing what's known as the percentage depletion allowance. That allows companies to deduct 15% of gross revenue, not cost, of a well. Opponents say the subsidy is worth most when oil prices and profits are high.
You can deduct right off the top 15% of your gross revenues. So that deduction could exceed the amount you've actually spent on developing the property over time.
Toder says the depletion allowance and the subsidy for intangible drilling benefits actually don't amount to much money.
These provisions are not that expensive in terms of their overall revenue loss to the Treasury. You know, you're talking about things that cost $1 billion a year, roughly.
That's not much money in Washington terms, but it's enough to keep both the major and minor producers lobbying hard. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A Canadian company is pushing the idea of a rail link from Alberta to Delta Junction. Vancouver-based Generating for Seven Generations, or G7G, wants to build the 1,600-mile railroad to export oil sands through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
G7G partner Matt Vickers says the $12 billion railroad project started with Canada-Alaska rail link studies conducted between 2005 and 2007. He says the Alaska-Yukon government-funded research was based on ore exports and showed the project to be uneconomic.
And then thought, what if we added other products? What if we added, say, the oil sands product to this? Would it be a viable entity then? Would it be a viable alternative? And lo and behold, yes.
Vickers says the railroad could deliver enough oil sands to Delta Junction to more than fill the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
We only did single track. We could do up to 1.5 million barrels per day. And twin tracking, we can do 4 to 5 million barrels per day.
The rail link is seen in Canada as an environmentally safer option to building an oil pipeline from Alberta to British Columbia and running tankers down the coastline. One of the many challenges to the railroad project is negotiating passage across native lands. Two of G7G's four partners, including Vickers, are of Aboriginal descent, and he says working with Indigenous people has long been a priority.
Go door to door with all the First Nations and meet with the leadership and explain the project and see if they would be open to us proceeding with it.
G7G announced official support last week from affected Canadian First Nations and Alaska tribes. Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says there's broad Alaska-side consensus on the rail line project.
Alaska Native villages have also passed resolutions that they're in support of this, and so has the governor, so have I submitted letters that this is an economic idea that should be pursued.
The proposed railroad has the potential for moving products beyond oil sands, including minerals, natural gas, food, and goods between Alaska, Canada, and the lower 48. Alaska Railroad External Affairs Manager Tim Sullivan says the Canadian project dovetails well with the railroad's plan to extend its track from North Pole to Delta Junction.
We haven't had a lot of contact, but we're very encouraged by the ideas that they have. And really think it would be a great thing for Alaska.
G7G is in the process of raising the final 10% of $40 million needed for a feasibility study. The company's Vickers says if the study proves up the project, financiers are ready to sign on. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the food bank in Fairbanks. Make sure families have a happy Thanksgiving.
It was packed with so much love by the community. It was packed by so much concern. And so one of the big messages that we're able to get out that day as well is that we care.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska Department of Labor Deputy Commissioner and former Juneau Assembly member David Stone is being remembered as a dedicated public servant, a mining historian, and a family man. Stone died unexpectedly Tuesday night after collapsing at his home. He was 55 years old. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
David Stone was elected to the Juneau Assembly in 2003, serving 9 years before term limits forced him to step down. At his final meeting last month, he joked that wasn't necessarily a bad thing.
I personally don't favor term limits, but in my case, I think it's a blessing.
Former Mayor Bruce Botello, heard laughing in that clip, served alongside Stone for his entire time on the Assembly. Stone was chairman of the Finance Committee for several years and also deputy mayor. Botello says he was a bridge builder who often mentored new members.
Invariably, members of the Assembly, regardless of where they lined up on this political spectrum, would work through David to try and reach agreement.
Current Mayor Merrill Sanford joined the Assembly a year before Botello and Stone.
We've kind of been in each other's shadow for the last 10 years very deeply, and he was a person who loved his community first, and then he loved Southeast Region, and then all of Alaska.
No cause of death has been announced, but Sanford says Stone apparently collapsed Tuesday night at about 5 o'clock after telling his wife, Laurel, he didn't feel well. The mayor and his wife went to the hospital to be with Mrs. Stone. He says she was surrounded by a group of close friends, but is understandably devastated.
Hopefully we can give her all the love and support and prayers that she needs to get her and the rest of the family through all of this.
Stone was deputy commissioner of the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Before state service, Stone worked for Alaska Electric Light and Power as director of consumer affairs and vice president of lands. He also was vice president of AJT Mining Properties, AEL&P's sister company. AEL&P president and CEO Tim McLeod says Stone kept close ties with the company even after taking jobs in government.
You couldn't find a better person to work with. Very level-headed, very well-liked. I mean, he was just a perfect person to have there to company.
Stone earned his bachelor's degree in geology from the University of Alaska. A lifelong resident of Juneau, he was a noted expert on Southeast Alaska mining and author of the book Hard Rock Gold. Botello says Stone's passion for mining history reminded him of the late Judge Thomas Stewart, another longtime Juneau public servant and historian who passed away in 2007.
David had certainly taken on the mantle as the preeminent mining historian, not only for Juneau, Southeast, but the entire state.
Stone was also involved with the Juneau Chamber of Commerce, Alaska Miners Association, and the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. He's survived by his wife, Laurel, and son, Brandon, a U.S. Navy SEAL who was severely injured in Afghanistan last year, as well as other members of an extended family that includes stepchildren and grandchildren. In Juneau, with help from Rosemarie Alexander and Matt Miller, I'm Casey Kelly.
The Fairbanks Community Food Bank served 46,000 residents last year. Half of them were children. This year, there's no telling where those numbers will shake out. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, today is the busiest day of the year for staff and volunteers who plan to fill at least 2,200 boxes with Thanksgiving food for families across the Tanana Valley.
More than 30 volunteers buzz around a warehouse like worker bees. They push carts, toss cans of food into boxes, and check lists. The Fairbanks Community Food Bank smells delicious, despite the cement floor and the fluorescent lighting. At the back of the warehouse, pallets are piled high with familiar foods.
My name's Larry Ballion. I'm a food bank volunteer.
We have stuffing over here.
Stuffing. You got cranberry sauce, soup, corn, green beans, and pumpkin and yams.
Okay. Over here,
we got potatoes, onions, carrots, and celery.
100% of this food has been donated by people like Brian Johnson. He saunters through the warehouse door and hands a fat, fresh turkey to a hurried volunteer.
I donate something every year, yes. We usually donate time. Sometimes we'll come do the boxes and whatnot, and this year I don't have the time, so I have the turkey. Hopefully they'll put it to good use, and so we'll enjoy it and have a good day.
Executive Director Samantha Kirstein isn't surprised. She's been with the food bank for more than two decades.
I've seen turkeys appear from nowhere. But I suppose the most memorable event in 23 years is the time I saw a man crossing the street. He was on crutches, and I remember the snow, I remember the moment. It was such one of those moments that you just remember. And he was coming to ask us for a food box, which we did not have. And all of a sudden, the person drove up in a car, and they had a perfectly, beautifully packed food box that they were able to hand to him. So those are the moments that we treasure, and it happens every Thanksgiving in some way.
Kirstein's daughter, Ann Weaver, is also an executive director. She expects at least 150 volunteers to help pack and deliver food boxes today. It's the busiest day of the year.
When folks go home on Thanksgiving with their boxes, they've got enough food to be able to feed their family or their household, whoever's with them. And it's really amazing. It was packed with so much love by the community. It was packed by so much concern. And so one of the big messages that we're able to get out that day as well is that we care.
Last year, the food bank planned to deliver 2,000 boxes, but the number climbed to 2,200. This year, the organization will pack 2,200, but there's no way to know just how many might go out. As for Brian Johnson's turkey, it will complete a food box filled with all the trimmings. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
When his Coast Guard helicopter crashed in 2010 on its way back to Sitka, Lieutenant Lance Leone, the co-pilot, was the only member of the four-person crew to survive. This week, we've been bringing you a three-part interview with Leone. On Monday, he talked about the moments leading up to the accident. Yesterday, he described the crash itself. Today, he talks with KCAW's Ed Ronco about the aftermath of the crash when the Coast Guard charged him with negligent homicide.
They told me that no one else survived. And from that moment on, I had to ask continuously why? And it was immensely troubling. And as I've talked to soldiers that have been coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan about this same issue, it affects them as well when their group is hurt and they say, why not me? Why didn't it happen to me? But then I don't know the right answer to how you heal the brain, but it's definitely slower than the physical side.
How were you ultimately informed of the charges? Do you get called into an office or what happens?
I was sitting there and I got a phone call from now Captain Cameron telling me to come back to the office. And I said, sir, I'm at the health fair. Can I wait until noon? He said, no, come back right now.
The air station's commanding officer informed Leone of the charges. Destruction of government property for the loss of the helicopter. Neglecting his duties as navigator by not avoiding the wires. And the military equivalent of negligent homicide for the deaths of the two crewmen aboard, Hoke and Banks.
I had formally been read those exact same charges during the admin investigation, but promised that they were just normal. You know, we have to always read you your rights before doing an investigation. So I'd seen those charges before. I'd seen the negligent homicide. I'd seen the dereliction of duty. But to now see it actually charged against me, all I could do was sit with my lower jaw gasping.
This is in then Commander Cameron's office?
Correct. And I asked him, what's next? What do we do next? And he said, well, because of the severity of the charges, you'll be taken to a Article 32. And he was extremely professional.
An Article 32 hearing is similar to a grand jury proceeding in civilian court. A military evaluator hears evidence and decides whether there's merit to proceed to a court-martial. Leone's hearing took place in Juneau in December. The Coast Guard said the helicopter was going too fast and that Leone fell short of his duties as navigator. Leone's attorneys argued the Coast Guard should have already removed the wires the chopper hit because they had been implicated in two other accidents. As the arguments went back and forth, Leone sat inside the courtroom and listened. But outside the courtroom, he tried not to think about it.
My family is unbelievable. My wife, my dad, my mom, stepmother, all my family, and then the Sitka family that came over on the ferry with me. How did I occupy my time without the trial is not talking about the trial. The first day of testimony was just so incredibly trying on my soul, being told of every single thing that I did wrong.
The Coast Guard dropped all charges against Leone, but issued what's called a final action memorandum on the accident. It said Leone directly contributed to the deaths of those on board, and it said he should have been more vocal in challenging Kruger, the pilot in command, when he made a low pass over the Coast Guard boat below. In a memo of his own, Leone says the black box voice recordings from the accident don't tell the whole story, and that he did challenge Kruger, using a method taught to him by the Coast Guard. He calls it floating a trial balloon.
You say things like, we might not have much radio communications this low, or there sure is a lot of bald eagles or birds down this low. You say stuff like that so that they pick up on your discomfort, but you allow them to then make a decision without you having to challenge their authority for the sole purpose of saying that you're uncomfortable. Because truth be told, when I first showed up in Sitka, I was very uncomfortable because it was different. I'd never flown below terrain. And that's something that I believe anyone that shows up in Alaska that flies below mountain ridges when you can't even see the top of the mountain, it's very different than any flying that I'd done before.
Okay, it's kind of like, boy, we're going really fast when you're in a car.
Yeah, or like, I hope there's not any cops around. It would be that type of stuff. Like that's what you got it. Boy, we're going pretty fast. Wow, I didn't know the car could go this fast. Instead of saying, slow down, you incompetent driver, I'm going to drive. That's the spectrum that clear, bold, and concise can take, you know.
With the Coast Guard's report came an admonishment from Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, the Coast Guard's commander in Alaska. Leone was transferred to a desk job in San Antonio, Texas. He's now a Coast Guard liaison to TRICARE, the military's health insurance arm, and he's awaiting word about promotion. His lawyer, John Smith, says the promotion is facing extra, unnecessary scrutiny. A Coast Guard board met this month and made a recommendation. That stays secret and heads to Admiral Robert Papp, the Coast Guard's commandant, in Washington, D.C.
They will decide the fate of my, really fate of my Coast Guard career, fate of me flying again.
If Papp allows the promotion to move ahead, Leone will become a lieutenant commander and receive back pay to August 1st, the date the promotion was scheduled to take effect. If Papp takes Leone off the promotion list, the matter moves to the desk of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. How has everything that's happened, I mean, from July 7th up until this current situation, how has this shaped the way you feel about the Coast Guard?
The Coast Guard is a great organization. It has developed me from when I was 17 to where I'm currently am, and this has really shown me and developed me, I think, more than if I had had nothing happen to me. It has developed my character. It has developed my knowledge of truth. It has developed how I deal with people, and it has really humbled me to how little I really control a lot of things in my life. But it's not changed my opinion of the Coast Guard.
I think people hear that and think, how can he still like the Coast Guard after all of this?
The amazing part is it's not the entire Coast Guard. I have gotten so much more support than any of the negative stuff. And it's a question that's hard for me to answer. I'm not one that gives up. I will continue pressing for what I believe is right, and I will not compromise my honor, respect, or devotion to duty like I've been taught. I will do what I believe is right for the Coast Guard. And I believe what's right is for me to go through this in there and see the process to finality.
Lieutenant Lance Leone spoke with KCAW's Ed Ronco. A decision on his promotion to lieutenant commander is not expected until January. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.